Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
My name's Gage Dvicek. Executive chef of 1919 Kitchen and Tap.
You're within the mothership of the Green Bay Packers.
Sure am, located inside Lambeau Field.
That's so cool. So that kind of guarantees you're going to get some clientele coming through here.
Absolutely.
No matter what. Yeah.
Yep, between the Rush Center being right across the street too, I mean, there's always events going on, and we see a lot of traffic from that for sure.
Yeah, that's crazy. So the world comes to you, literally.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah. So let's back up in time for a moment. Talk to us about your culinary journey. You know, where did you grow up and how did it happen for you?
I started in restaurants when I was 15. I started at a local diner in Appleton, Wisconsin. I started as a dishwasher at that point. I had no idea, you know, I wanted to be a cook or anything like that. I worked there until I was like 17. One morning, all of a sudden, the cooks walked out.
Wow.
And
tag, you're it.
Yeah, basically. The manager at the time, like, looked over, she's like, I know you've seen a bunch of these dishes I go through, and you know, like, we want you to try this, I'll work with you. It was a very rough first day.
I bet.
I mean, it was
brutal.
It was a busy, it was a Sunday breakfast, so right after church. And it was definitely very busy. For some reason, it literally was that very first day, I just got crushed, and I was just like, I'm one of those type of people, I'm very determined, and I was like, oh, like, I need to be better at this.
So it didn't stop you at all?
No, I need to do this.
So it was the challenge, huh?
Yeah, I've always been like that. There's certain things, like, it just, I get locked in, I want to do it. The further I got into it, I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the people of the industry. I fell in love with just the energy that you have within the kitchens, the food, like, it's just all of it. From there, I ended up going Fox Valley Technical College.
And they have a culinary program there.
They do, very good culinary program. And I really wanted to expand. I wanted to get my fundamentals in there. I wanted to be able to build off of something, and that seemed like the perfect place to start. I did a lot of networking there. I actually joined a competition team where we actually went to New Orleans, first team from Wisconsin to go to nationals, and we took gold. We won.
Oh, wow, dude.
Yeah.
How did you pull that off? You must have had some tricks up your sleeve.
No, practicing 50 hours a week, and on top of that, doing 25 hours of school, on top of working 45 hours at work as well.
Wow, that's crazy.
And it was just, I mean, it was very tiring, but it was just wanting to do it, you know, and it showed off. It was that hard work that really paid off for me.
But again, it's more than you, it's that team, right?
It is. It's the team dynamic. That's the most beautiful thing. Like, there's a quote out there, and I don't know who it's from. It talks about there's no great chef without a great team. Prime example of what we did tonight with our beer dinner, it was the same thing. Like, we wouldn't have been able to do any of this without the front of house or back of house team.
Something that I think too many people take for granted is the front of the house, even your delivery people, you know, the timing of the plating, bringing it all out at once and it's all equally warm. I mean, that's an art in itself.
It is.
That timing, yeah.
It is, yeah. It's a symphony. It's this dance, you know, everything from that back of house to how the plates move throughout the restaurant. Like, it's a beautifully orchestrated thing.
And I haven't been here when you've been slammed, but you know when the Green Bay Packers are playing here, you guys don't shut down. You go viral.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you have to keep up with that pace, frenetic pace.
Yeah, and a lot of that is those same people working 65, 75, 85 hours a week, and they're pushing. I mean, we definitely, you know, we serve a lot of people on those days. Mm-hmm. A little glimpse of it is game day weekends, we go through 550 pounds of cheese curds.
Wow, in one day?
Yeah, and the day before a game.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's just, the volume is intense, but it's one of those things. It's that orchestra. It's that symphony. Everybody's working, and the food's just coming out seamlessly. It's beautiful.
Total metaphor for teamwork at its finest, right?
Absolutely.
Because it would break down real quick, even one weak link.
Yeah, if you have one rift in there, and it affects the whole dynamic. It affects it all the way out to the guest.
Talk to us about your philosophy of cuisine. I imagine, you're in the heartland, so you can do a real broad palette of what you do.
I always talk to myself whenever they ask me, like, what's your favorite thing to cook? What do you enjoy doing the most? And I always answer it the same. It's, I'm passionately curious.
Mm-hmm.
So I love every aspect of it. I love the Midwest, what they have to offer. You know, a lot of that roasted chicken and, you know, the beef tips and stuff, and then expanding off of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned under a lot of different, like, French chefs, too. So, like, I mean, that's the mother of cuisine. So right. A lot of those fundamentals that came over here.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it all kind of originates or was organized over there. So it's hard to pick any one dynamic, but I my favorite, I would have to say, would just be that comfort food.
The best of the Midwest.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, that stuff that makes you feel like you're home.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about tonight. This was a new and a special event for you guys, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we've done beer dinners before, but it was on a very small scale. Mm-hmm. So when we were kind of sitting down with Leinenkugel's, we were like, oh, you know, like, let's make this big. You know, let's see how big we can make this. You know, it was one of those challenging things, you know, like, it's like.
So you didn't know it was going to flop or succeed.
Yeah, no, yeah. I had absolutely no idea. You know, we put it out there as like, you know, this is what our cap is. And, you know, let's see what traction we can get on it. And it turned out amazing. We sold out.
Yeah. And what a great dinner, man. What fun. And I loved her beers in perfect pairing.
Oh,
you must have had fun kind of meditating on which beer would go.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that was another part of that team dynamic too. So like, we, you know, we would taste it, and then we'd have people at, you know, one of our cooks asking questions like, how does this make sense together? And we really could dive in with them, and they're like, you know, like the bitterness from this green gets cut by this richness. And it was a beautiful thing. It really goes to show, like, all these minds coming into one, and this is what came out. It was a beautiful thing.
Talk for a quick second about Leinenkugel's history. They go back, what, six generations? 1850s here?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, even from when I was growing up, I mean, it's always been like a household name in the sense of, like, when you know, you talk about the different beers and stuff, like, Leinenkugel's been in that conversation. So, I mean, it was actually kind of cool to be able to actually meet the family.
Yeah.
And then, you know, be able to use their beers and, like, have this event with them.
So tonight, the mother and aunt was here.
Yep. Daughter. Mother, aunt. Yep. Another daughter was here. Yep. Yeah. It was awesome.
So talk to us about how you paired the different dishes tonight and dovetailing with her beers.
Yeah. So, I mean, we, you know, you take the beer and we went through, like, an extensive tasting where, you know, we would just kind of get every note that we could out of this beer and kind of really figure out, like, the contrast to it. I mean, that's the biggest thing that you can do on any pairing is, you know, like, the richness from the coffee, also, like, the chocolate as well. So, like, you know, coffee, chocolate go together. So it's like, well, what can we do with that, you know? So you devise, like, all these different flavor profiles and you see what can kind of even out what, and then you come with this, like, this beautiful harmony of the dish.
Were there any kind of epiphanous moments for you? Learning curve expansions through?
I think the learning curve actually came from some of the beers that we used. I was familiar with the Juicy Peach. The other three beers I was not very familiar with. So, I mean, with anything, I mean, research. You have to understand, you know, kind of what you're dealing with. So, I mean, my learning curve kind of came from, like, you know, what direction do I want to go with this?
So her beer has expanded your retinue, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and that's with anybody. I mean, whenever you do anything like that, their knowledge of, you know, their craft, it definitely is it's that same thing.
That's really cool. Looking forward, you're happy here, and just kind of fine-tune the empire.
Yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit here. I mean, we drive to be very local, and we drive to, you know, support the community, and we love to expand off of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where there's a will, there's a way. Like, we want to do, you know, the big thing here.
Again, it cracks me up. You know, I mean, you're at the mothership. Lambeau Field, Green Bay Packers, the world comes to you.
Yeah.
I love
absolutely.
It. To learn more about your world, you guys have social media presence or website go to?
Yep, 1990 is on Facebook. We have our website as well, where there's more information on there too. Hannah, which she was the main marketing person of this. I mean, we've been working with her to really kind of amp up, and our name has been known, but we want to be bigger than that. You know,
and 1919 is a seminal moment in the history of the Green Bay Packers.
It is.
That was the first year when the team was formed, right?
Yep. Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of a beautiful thing because it's like, you know, this is where it started.
Well, the front of the house is shutting down. It's time for us to go.
Yeah.
So to learn more about your world, once again, Gage, go to social media.
Yeah, social media. So Facebook, 1919 is probably going to be the best way to see our most current stuff.
That's too simple.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, Gage, thanks.
Gage Dvicek, executive chef of 1919 Kitchen and Tap.
Nice. And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Green Bay, Wisconsin. We'll see you here. Going back to 1919.
I'm Alex Falish. We're at Noble Roots Brewing Company in Green Bay, Wisconsin, drinking some delicious beer.
I love it. Tell us about the family history and how you guys decided to create.
Yeah. Yes, we're a 100% family-owned business, and we decided to start homebrewing after a family trip to Europe where we really, our eyes were open to craft beer.
And including your dad.
Tell us
that backstory. That's really cool.
So at the time, my dad worked for a beer distributor. I won't say the name, but one of the big guys. And the joke used to be when the brewery guys came to visit from somewhere else in the Midwest, we'll say, they would drink the heavy version of that beer, and he would have to sneak ice cubes into his because he really wanted, he was a light beer drinker.
A super light.
Super light beer drinker. And then, you know, hitting breweries in Belgium that have been around for hundreds of years really kind of opened our eyes. We got back stateside, we started homebrewing. And I like to joke that it's just a hobby that spiraled a little bit out of control, right. And we ended up with a brewery.
And your dad is involved with you on a day-to-day operation.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
so he bailed on corporate world.
Yes, he got out of that. You know, you can find us here every Sunday brewing. Yeah, he does more of the sales and distribution. I do more of the recipe design, but it's definitely a team effort.
And your mom, is she?
Yeah, really, I mean, the whole family's involved. My older brother does all of our marketing. My wife helps out with some of the labeling. My mom does labeling and a lot of keeps us in check. It's really a full family effort here.
That's really cool. And tell us about, even for yourself, your kind of epiphanous moment going to Europe and Belgium.
Yeah, so my epiphany moment actually didn't come till later. So we had been homebrewing for quite a few years, and then I actually went and studied abroad in Germany. I went to a small private business school, but in reality, I was pretty much studying beer. I came back, and I had actually taken a semester off of school for a job. During that time, I was like, okay, we're still homebrewing, but we kind of just doing a lot of the same stuff. I'm like, okay, now we're going to get a little bit more into it. And from that point, that's kind of what set us on the track to actually starting the brewery.
Interesting. And so your whole flavor profile and palate of what excites you in beer has dramatically exploded.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Personally, I tend to drink more IPAs, but this area of the country or the state is really big into Belgian beers. So
is there any explanation for that?
Well, the Belgians had settled heavily in this area and then up into Door County. There's some old stories of a priest that moved into Door County and was just sending pamphlets back to the homeland, encouraging people to move. So I think that definitely has something to do with the taste.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I'm big about experimenting. I just want to try new beer styles. That's what I like.
You're perpetually pushing the limit.
Absolutely.
Talk to us about gummy bears.
Yeah. So the recipe is not done yet, but we'll be brewing it pretty soon. But I'm going to do a dirt cake imperial stout. So, you know, that favorite dessert that people brought into school for their birthday in elementary school with, is it pudding and whipped cream and the Oreos on top with a nice gummy worm, putting all that into a beer, and we'll see how it turns out.
That's hilarious. So you have no fear. You have no boundaries.
No, we've I think our anniversary beer this year was, it was an Imperial Stout with marshmallows, cocoa powder, chocolate syrup, just a lot of sweets into a stout.
That's a trip.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of your most viral products that people just, there'd be riots if you tried to take it off.
Our biggest one is our blueberry cream, which actually just ran out not that long ago. So we bring it out in early May, and then it goes away sometime in the fall. But it's cream ale is a kind of a Wisconsin style that was made when refrigeration wasn't really prevalent, so you couldn't make lagers. But it was meant to, in a sense, mimic a lager. But from a grain standpoint, it was... I've never read anywhere, but it seems like it's like whatever they could find. So there's usually some corn, some rice, some oats, some flaked barley. But it really builds this base beer that's smooth and creamy, and then it just has just a hint of blueberry. When that comes out in the summer, that's usually our busiest day of the year.
Interesting. I've interviewed quite a few beer and whiskey producers, distillers, growers, whatever. And one guy will go, oh, so we throw the yeast in. Mm-hmm. And the next guy goes off for a half hour just about yeast.
Yeah.
What role does yeast play in your flavor profile?
I mean, I'm more of the subscriber to the brewers make the wort, the yeast makes the beer.
Right.
And it's wildly important. And there's plenty of breweries around that pretty much have one house yeast that makes most of their beer. We have four yeasts that we keep year round. We need one for lager. We have one for most of our ales. We keep an English yeast around. Because we brew so many Belgian beers, we have a Belgian yeast on all the time. It's a lot to manage, but it's wildly important. Yeast imparts a lot of flavor. You could take a light beer like our Beyond the Pale, and if we threw in a different yeast than the lager, it's going to taste 1,000% different.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah,
it's
microbes.
Yeah. It's even more insane to think that 300-400 years ago, we had no idea that was going on.
Yeah, I know. And that trip on that whole native yeast fermentation, I was talking to a distiller in Indiana, and he went to like 150-year-old winery and was scraping the walls to harvest yeast.
Yeah.
And he said his wife is all upset because he has one whole refrigerator
just full of yeast.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a cool concept that I think is starting to hit the U.S. a little bit more is what the Belgians have been doing for hundreds of years, and is using cool ships and then letting wild yeast from the environment inoculate, and then that's what takes off. I'm hoping that we can play around with that a little bit more. We're actually in the process of building a new production facility, not too far from here, but a little bit more out into the country. And that kind of opens the opportunity to play around with that a little bit more. See what kind of yeast is floating in the air.
I love it. The reason why you're doing that is because you outgrew this place,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we probably outgrew it in a couple months. But we were waiting for the right time to expand. So we're really proud of what we built from a taproom perspective here. It's cozy. People want to hang out. You know, when it's dreary outside, it's nice and warm and cozy in here. We're going to keep that, but we're just building a new facility so we can produce a lot more beer.
Like right now, we're like your living room.
Yep, that's exactly. We figured if we built a place that we would want to hang out in, then we'd be fine. And I think we've accomplished that.
Yeah, well, there's something so warm and comfy and inviting about it. Back to producing and dreaming and envisioning. Talk to us about some of your best successes and what the critical variables were that made that happen.
I think it's all about trial and error. So because we get to experiment super, super often.
You have no fear of failure.
No. I mean, we've certainly had to dump beers before because if it's not good enough to release, we dump it. And then I cry a little bit over the beer and then I get over it and learn where it didn't go right. That's given us a lot of opportunity to just try new things. Things that I'm probably most proud of, I'm really proud of some of the hazy IPAs that we've made. It's not a style that I really wanted to touch a whole lot, but because it's complicated, but I'm really proud of some of those that we've done.
You can do controls and understand the variables
so
that you can reproduce right on.
Yeah. Man, what beers I'm most proud of? There's too many. It's like picking a favorite child.
Right. Let's go down your list.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would be... If I only had time for one beer, what would it be?
Okay, out of the ones out of our year-round beers that I'm probably most proud of is our... that's so tough. I think I'm going to have to go with our Blonde Belgian. Belgian blonde ales are kind of an underappreciated style. They're very nuanced. You really have to take care of the yeast to make sure that it produces the flavors that you want. And that's a beer that really took off day one for us. And, you know, we go through a ton in our tap room, but we also... There's a lot of bars and restaurants, even ones that are like next to each other, that will put that beer on tap, even though the place down the street still has it. So I'm really proud of that beer.
Part of that explanation is a local following, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They come expecting to find it.
Yeah.
Talk about distribution for a moment. Is it mostly within the Green Bay region?
Or? It's pretty much only Green Bay. You know, we try to go a little up into Door County and a little down into Appleton, but we really are producing as much as this building can physically produce at this point.
There's also bodies, too.
Yeah.
You just tell your dad he has to drive a semi.
Yeah, and it's exactly right. It's either myself or my dad that are delivering half barrels or cans to wherever, whatever day of the week. So it'll be nice when we can produce a little bit more. That'll make all of that a little easier. Yeah.
But I think you have a default blessing in your guys' lives. It's kind of like, don't touch that dial.
Yeah.
Because you might regret it when you're
That's true.
You can't sleep anymore.
That's true.
All right. Well, we could go on and on, but I really appreciate you sharing. This
Yeah, thank you so much.
Wonderful. To learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Yeah, you can find us on Facebook or Instagram. That's Noble Roots Brewing Company. Website is noblerootsbrewing.com. I'm Alex Falish.
Alex, thank you so much, man. This has been great.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, now I want to come back. I haven't even left yet.
Thanks.
All right. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Green Bay, Wisconsin. We'll see you here.
I am Tom Feld. I am the owner and distiller here at Paradise North Distillery in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
You're right on the bay, aren't you?
Yeah, literally right on the bay. Oddly enough, one of the few businesses located directly on Green Bay in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Isn't that a paradox?
I know. It's strange.
It would be a waterfront town.
Yeah, exactly. But it's...
You think that's because of the industrial history?
That's exactly what it is. You know, part of what's changing some in Green Bay is kind of recognizing the value of places like this. The building we're in used to be a warehouse. It's kind of funny now, thinking about it, it's like, you know, they had warehousing with a beautiful view.
Right.
So they're recognizing the value of that for other types of businesses like ours.
I've been here before, and when you reinvented the waterfront downtown,
right,
which used to be, locals said it was a no-go area.
Right, exactly. It's the same thing. You know, it's always been there, just the priorities or the uses of it have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that whole reinvention of the live-work downtown, so you have some dynamic things going on in the evenings.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not downtown, but we're about a 2-minute drive from downtown. Green Bay's not really that spread out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a lot down there. So people can take advantage of what's down there. Mm-hmm. We're a short drive just out here on the bay, so a lot of options.
Well, one of my favorite places in town is right down the waterfront, and that's the classic oldest, most cool amusement park.
Oh, yeah, Bay Beach, exactly. Just right down the street from us.
That's right out of Hollywood.
Yeah, it is. You know, when people come to Green Bay and they ask me, you know, where to go, what to do, that type of thing, you know, there's certainly Packer-related things,
sure,
and that's a big draw.
That's
but
almost the big shadow that casts over
it. It is, yeah, but there's so much more, and Bay Beach is just a hidden gem. You just don't find places like that are still so affordable. And
the classic wooden roller coaster.
Yeah. I'm at a point in my life where my kids are now adults, so I don't really have a reason to go there, although my wife and I do go ride the Zip and Pip and the roller coaster on occasion.
Yeah.
But now I have grandchildren, so I'm like, okay, in another year or two, now we get to go through that all again. I'm really looking forward to it.
Let's go back to you.
Yeah.
Where we are. This is a new building, right?
The building is quite old. Like I had said before, it used to be warehouse built in the 50s, mm-hmm. but now, yeah, our portion converted into the distillery. Mm-hmm. So it consists of the tasting room area, the out front part, and then the back part is our production area where we do the actual distilling.
That's your background, distiller?
No, not at all. Most of my career has been spent in accounting, finance related. I've owned some other businesses, but...
So this is a game shift for you.
It is. Early on, I knew I wanted to own a business. So I did that, but it was always from that accounting numbers mm-hmm. perspective. The missing piece for me is I knew at some point in time I wanted to do a business where I was hands-on. I wanted to actually make something.
So this is literal hands-on.
So it is very hands-on. You know, it took a while to figure out what that was, and is probably roughly 10 years ago when just the idea occurred of opening a distillery.
And what attracted you to that?
Well, it met that hands-on requirement. So that was kind of the first part. It allows for a lot of creativity, which when I worked in accounting, that does not allow for a lot of creativity.
Yeah. You get in trouble.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, it kind of filled that niche for me. And then beyond that, as I started digging into it, you know, I ran across the fact that the city of Green Bay, which is a very old city, has never had a working distillery.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
This is the first ever in the history of Green Bay.
Next.
A lot of breweries, mm-hmm. certainly some wineries, but never a distillery. So it was like, wow, I can actually, in addition to just meeting some of my personal goals and needs, we're able to bring something to Green Bay that's never existed before.
With some of my distiller friends, we joke that brewers are distillers who gave up to her.
Yeah, that's what I always say. We finished the job. Yeah, exactly.
But a lot
yeah.
of people don't realize that's like you are a brewer.
Yeah,
you
that's
start
the,
out by making beer, right?
Yeah, the first step of the process, fermentation, mm-hmm. while it's not exactly the same, okay. fundamentally, it's the same whether you're making wine or you're making beer. The process of making the actual mm-hmm. alcohol is fermentation. So a lot of similarities.
And you
in that.
Literally are hands-on.
Yeah, you we are. Do it. I am here pretty much every day. We do it all right here.
And how did you garner your knowledge base?
Number of different ways. I certainly read everything I could get my hands on. A lot of information online. Took some classes. But probably the biggest thing for me was spending some time with other distillers here in the state who were tremendously helpful in learning the craft and learning the business. Yeah, I got a lot of help from other distillers. It's a real close-knit and open community. If there's a need, there are distillers that are willing to help out.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about what you do and how you do as far as your end result
yeah,
of the product.
Sure. Our primary focus here at Paradise North is on rum and whiskey, mm-hmm. and in particular bourbon whiskey. So,
do you find difference between rum?
So not every spirit, but many of the spirits are defined at least in part based on the raw material that they're made from. Mm-hmm. So rum is something that is fermented and distilled from sugar cane mm-hmm. or a byproduct of
so
sugar cane.
It has cane. To be that to be rum.
It has to be, yeah. Mm-hmm. This part of the country, I'll get asked that a lot. Well, what about sugar beets? Can you make rum
sure,
from sugar beets?
Could you?
And you can ferment and distill, mm-hmm. but you can't call that rum.
So it has to be a cane sugar.
It has to be sugar
so
cane.
So where do you source your cane?
Louisiana. Uh-huh. You know, we buy all of our raw materials locally.
Where you can.
Well, relatively speaking. Yeah. So we get our molasses and raw sugar that we use to make rum from the closest sugar cane grower to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Uh-huh. It just happens to be 1,100 miles away. But so that's rum. So whiskey is spirit that is fermented and distilled from grain. Now, in the case of bourbon is a type of whiskey mm-hmm. that has further definitions.
There are some real specific.
Yeah, very much
that.
So.
Yeah.
As we're speaking about grain, bourbon has to be at least 51% corn in mm-hmm. the mash bill in order to call it bourbon. And then
and
there are some other things.
That harkens back to Kentucky roots, right?
Yeah, although Virginia would make claim to being the mm-hmm. birthplace of bourbon. There's some argument there. I don't know which one has it, mm-hmm. but yeah, that
but
part of the country.
Kentucky ran with it.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Definitely. Mm-hmm. Bourbon is, it's the one spirit that's unique to the United States. So you can make bourbon anywhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. If you could make the same thing in a different country, but you wouldn't be able to call it bourbon.
In the case of bourbon, one of the rules, as I remember, is once used, new oak. You don't reuse your barrels.
And
the Scottish people love them because of that.
Well, yeah. The Scotch whiskey people love that. Rum people love that, too.
Because you can use used oak for your rum.
Exactly. And that's part of what we do. Now, we just started releasing some of our own bourbon, but, you know, our bourbon barrels.
How much can you reuse
a bourbon? I mean, how often can you reuse it?
Yeah, let's say you get a once-used bourbon barrel and you're going to use it for your rum. So now it's second use. What happens on the third and fourth?
Yeah, so rum, you could get a couple more uses out of that with rum. The other thing with those barrels is, like, we've already started to do some collaborative projects with wineries and breweries in the area, so they will take our used barrels.
They like what you're giving them.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And then when they're done with those barrels, we will take them back.
Wow.
So
Can you rechar?
Yes, you can. I don't know that we will do that.
Sure.
But, I'm going to say easily 5-6 uses out of a barrel. So, yeah, they get a lot of use before they're used up.
And let's jump to whiskey.
Yeah.
Because that's normally, what, one time with the barrel?
Bourbon whiskey, most whiskeys, but not all.
Okay.
Yeah, because Scotch is a whiskey, and they're using used barrels. Corn whiskey uses a used barrel, but yeah, in the case of bourbon that we do, those are all new charred oak barrels, white oak barrels.
And so, how do you make your whiskey not be lighter fluid, but be a really fun taste experience?
So our particular process here, there's a few areas of focus for us. One is on fermentation. So how we ferment, and then the yeast that we use for fermentation, is everything we do there is specific to developing a particular flavor profile that we're after.
So that's a huge variable in your ingredients, because you don't have that many variables.
Right. So that's a very important part of the process. So we do that in such a way, we want a fermentation that creates a lot of flavors. That's part of our program. Then in the distillation process, that's the other part, is we only do pot distillation. So again, if we're looking at doing like column distillations or some other methods of distillation that might be designed to remove some flavors, our process is designed to not remove,
to
maintain those flavors through
the
process.
Pot still, that's kind of classic old school Scotch.
It is. We have two different style stills, but our still that we use for our finish or our final distillation is called an alembic style still, which you don't see that style of still used much in bourbon production. Rum, yes, very common. They're also very common with brandy. But again, it gives us a very unique and different flavor profile off of the still.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the one right in front of us, that's a classic.
It is.
That looks like you cut a deal with a moonshiner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's that alembic style. Mm-hmm. Very old type. Yeah. Very old. One of, if not the first style of still. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we have found now, we've found this with whiskey, but we're also noticing it with rum, is aging. We kind of have a interesting like microclimate thing going on here. Being located right on the bay, our humidity is higher than in many areas of the state. Now, the state of Wisconsin is fairly high humidity to begin with, but what that does is humidity will affect how the spirit ages. We lose, our angel share is less, so what evaporates out of the barrels is less than many distillers.
That's because of the moisture in the air.
It is, yeah. So in dry climates, you tend to lose a lot,
but
less
here,
so in humid.
2%?
Well, we were at, there's a lot of variables to that, but in our 15-gallon barrels, we lost 11% in 16 months.
How long do you typically age your whiskey?
Our target for our initial barreling was in 15-gallon barrels, which is a smaller format mm-hmm. barrel. Our target there is 18 months. Mm-hmm. Our initial release was less than that, but we'll be at 18 months real shortly here.
And have you played around with librarying some and see what happens?
I do hope to put some away, not so much in the 15-gallon barrels, mm-hmm. but we're filling 30-gallon barrels. Right. And our target there is to be at least 2 years with the 30 gallons. Mm-hmm. But with those, I do have some that I hope to not mm-hmm. have to release to be right. able to stash those away.
What's the differential, do you imagine, holding it for another year or two?
Well, so the thing that age gets you with any spirit is, the easiest way for me to describe it is, the spirit just tends to mellow, and it's mm-hmm. why people are drawn to aged spirits. You know, an unaged spirit or a lightly aged spirit just has a bit of a bite to it that mm-hmm. you don't get in the older spirits. Yeah. But there's a lot of other things going on underneath that in terms of the development of flavor profiles and esters and right. the, you know, acids and alcohols joining to create flavors.
One of the disconnects that you as an accountant would totally appreciate, if you tie up a barrel for an extra 4 years, you have no return on investment for that whole time.
Yeah. If I get asked, you know, why are some things, you know, more expensive than mm-hmm. others and so forth, one of the primary things that you pay for is age. Because, yeah, it costs to leave that sit, you know. It costs to have that space to keep those barrels in. Yeah.
Do you sell everything you produce here, basically, or do you distribute around the state?
We are distributed. That just got started this year. Mm-hmm. So we really, in the last few months, have picked up some momentum with that. Primarily right now, mostly Northeast Wisconsin, few exceptions, mm-hmm. and more so higher-end restaurants and bars, a few liquor stores. But yeah, starting out, the bulk of our business has been right here through our tasting room.
Talk to us about your flagship. You know, what do people think of and come looking for and remember?
Yeah, so rum is kind of our niche. Not that there aren't other distillers in the state that do rum, but not to the extent that we do. And part of that is, rum is one of my passions. I think it's a highly underrated and misunderstood spirit. Mm-hmm. So it was something that I knew from the very beginning that I wanted to do, and I really wanted to dive into it and specialize in it.
Entering international competition?
Actually, we have. Okay. So we've done 3 competitions this last year, so earlier in 2022, and have done quite well, and rum is what we've sent off. Our silver rum has won both gold and silver medals at different competitions, Denver, New York, the ADI, which is the Distillers Association competition.
That's pretty cool.
Our coffee rum has done really well. At the ADI competition, it was awarded best in category, so it was the top rated of all the flavored products that were judged. So, yeah, we've only done a few, but we've already been getting some really good feedback.
Cool. So when somebody comes here, what's the lexicon? What are the options of tasting?
Oh, so when we do tours here, we will, as part of our tours, it includes a tasting, and we're up to 13 different products now, and we let people choose between the various types of rum. We have a couple of bourbons, a few different types of vodkas, so there is quite a choice. And different people tend to gravitate towards different things. Some people like the flavored things. They like some of the sweeter things. Some people just like to stick to the bourbons and like our gold rum, which is our aged rum. They prefer those types of products. So, you know, a little bit of kind of something for everyone.
So at this point, the majority of your world is retail people coming here to have a fun experience.
Yeah, we're a distillery. We distill spirits, mm-hmm. but our goal is more than that. A lot of it is, you know, we started out talking about our location and where we're at. A lot of it is just creating an escape. I'll tell my staff that I really judge our success based on smiles and laughs in the mm-hmm. tasting room. People are happy.
Yep.
That's what we want. Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, I should let you go. This has been really fascinating, Tom.
Thank you.
Tom, to learn more about your world, where would you direct us?
Online is the best place to go. Our website is ParadiseNorthDistillery.com. Facebook is also, if for people who are on social media, Facebook and Instagram, we're very active on there. That's like the most current information in terms of what we have going on. Our address is 101 Bay Beach Road in Green Bay. It's pretty easy to get to if you can find Bay Beach Road. You just
look for the roller coaster.
Exactly. Go past Bay Beach all the way to the end and hang a right. We're located at the South Bay Marina Complex right on the water.
Awesome, Tom. Thanks again.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we've been speaking with Tom Feld, president and ruler of Paradise North Distillery in Green Bay, Wisconsin. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you here.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer on KCBX Radio. Please support your local NPR station.
I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.